Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is Fortune's Wheel, a podcast history of the late Middle Ages, and I'm Jonathan. On the last episode, we saw Palermo fall, and Muslim rule in Sicily have its future writ large for all to see, though some stubborn ones in the west and the south of the island wouldn't take the warning for several more years. Today, we see the aftermath of the Norman victory at Palermo, but in addition to this, we will also get our hearts ripped from our chests. Or maybe it was just me. This is episode 120, and it's entitled Two Brothers, Two Paths. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoy the show. On January 10th, 1072, the Duke of Sicily finally entered into Sicily's most populated, wealthy, and culturally integrated city. Though he still did not control cities like Trapani in the northwest, Agrigento in the southwest, Enna right smack in the middle, and Syracuse in the far southeast of the island, though half of the island still eluded him, I wonder if this might have been the first time he actually believed it was possible to be the Duke of Sicily in more than just title. Entering the gates, Robert Guiscard was accompanied by his warrior wife, Sicilgaita, as well as his little brother, Count Roger. Behind them was Guy of Salerno, his brother-in-law, and his nephew, the incomparable juggernaut, Serlo II. They worked their way up the streets to the tepid fanfare as the people of Palermo were still wary of their new Christian overlords. Santa Maria had been a mosque for 240 years as of 1072, but in the preceding day or two, it had been quickly reconsecrated to be a cathedral, a Catholic one. And that was where, interestingly, Robert underwent the Greek rites led by the Archbishop of Palermo. Apparently, chronicler Amatus of Monte Cassino adds that angels directly from heaven graced those in attendance with their presence. Now, it's worth mentioning just a little bit of the complexity of the situation, a little bit of the complexity of Palermo. Now, Santa Maria was in 1072 quickly, like I said, reconsecrated to be a Catholic cathedral, but why did Robert undergo Greek rites? Well, it's because originally the Greeks, the Byzantines, the Orthodox Christians had run the city of Palermo. When the Muslims took over, they made it a mosque. Now that the Catholics are back, they have reconsecrated to be a Catholic cathedral, but the Byzantine Greek Orthodox population was still a large presence in Palermo. So, again, just to kind of unlock some of those complexities to the whole situation. Now, by January 10th, reports began pouring in about smaller cities and towns and smaller regions, just throwing in the towel and asking for Norman rule rather than fighting against it. They reasoned, and fair enough to be honest, that if Palermo of all places couldn't hold out against the Normans, then what chance did they have? Places like Mazara in the southwest were one of those who just gave in right away. Others, like the cities of Agrigento, Trapani, Enna, Syracuse, as I said before, well, they still held out. But the writing, again, was on the wall at this point. It might actually just be a matter of time. As for the details of who actually rules what, well, so Robert Guiscard is obviously the overlord, the top dog of Apulia, Calabria, and more or less now Sicily. But below that, there were some details to iron out. Roger was the Count of Reggio, but he'd put the most work by far into subduing the island in his brother's name. So he probably deserved something more than just Reggio, right? Robert, in his newfound spirit, here's the word again, of magnanimity, reserved for himself complete control over Palermo, half of Messina, and half of the Val di Monte. Why those specific regions? Because he acknowledged that he'd only participated in these little conquests. He gave everything else in Sicily, to Roger. And Roger was elevated from merely Count of Reggio to the title of Great Count of Sicily. To boot, Robert promised Roger that anything Roger captured in the future, he could claim as part of his title and land holdings, given that he still gave the proper money and loyalty and aid and support and all those things to his duke at a moment's notice. Norwich writes that the same holds for Roger's, quote, two principal lieutenants, Serlo de Hauteville and Arisco of Pozzuoli, end quote. Duke Robert would spend until at least the autumn of 1072, so we're talking about 9 months after the official fall of Palermo, he would spend there in Palermo. There was nothing the Normans couldn't do, it seemed, though Abelard was still leading another rebellion over in Apulia against Robert's rule. Robert chose to solidify what he and his brother had gathered on the island, which is saying something about Robert's chosen priorities in 1072. Sicily was no longer merely a jewel of Islam. It was now the jewel in the Norman crown. But this was the 11th century, and this was life, you know? And life wasn't always pleasant, especially for those who sought the unpleasantness of life by putting his chin out and daring others to punch it. Seems like a very Norman thing to do. Or better, putting his chin out and daring others to hack it off at the neck. And we enter Alp Arslan. That's right. Humor me here and follow me across the Mediterranean and Anatolia to where the Turks are currently steering themselves back to their ancestral lands of the Central Asian steppes. After the incredible defeat at Manzikert in 1071, his victory over the superior forces of the Eastern Roman Empire and the subsequent friendship forged with the humiliated and abandoned emperor, Romanus IV, we'll see Alp Arslan gathered his forces for a foray back into the northeast from whence they came, past Anatolia and Armenia, to where his grandfathers called home. His empire, the Seljuk Empire, had conquered Baghdad, extended itself far out west, almost toward Jerusalem, threatened the Fatimid dynasty out of Cairo, bested and captured the Eastern Roman Emperor, as I said, in as little as a generation. So in as little as a generation, well, Alp Arslan wanted Central Asia now, too. That seemed like a very Turk thing to do. In the summer of 1072, he and his Seljuk army were barreling down on fortresses lining the Oxus River, today called the Amu Darya, which runs down the borderlands between Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan. The Oxus River was in the far reaches of Turkmen territory. Those lands were under the direct control of a chieftain named Yusuf al-Harani. Alp Arslan captured al-Harani at one of the fortresses along the Oxus. And when he had al-Harani before him, Arslan ordered the chieftain to be assassinated. However, plot twist, al-Harani lunged at Alp Arslan, who was caught completely unawares, and got in a good 3 or 4 stabs with his concealed knife before he was shot full of arrows. Bleeding out and in utter shock, the mighty Alp Arslan, Sultan of the Seljuk Empire, would hang on for a few days before succumbing to his wounds. Before he passed away, he named his successor. His son, Malik Shah, would become the new sultan, and Malik Shah would enjoy a fairly smooth transition into the role, which is, no matter where you are at the time, very notable for the time, as smooth transitions of power were just not the norm. And that, my friends, is the end to one of the mightiest Turks of all time. Another death, actually, occurred in 1072 as well, most likely around the same time as Alp Arslan's, but honestly, it could have been in the fall as well. We just don't know. Now, we know that there was a papal schism between 1061 and 1072 with Pope Alexander II and anti-Pope Honorius II. Alexander was supported by the vast majority of the non-German bishops, as well as some pretty powerful Normans, such as Duke William of Normandy, Duke Robert Guiscard of Apulia, Calabria, and Sicily, and Count Roger of Reggio, or now Great Count of Sicily. Honorius, well, he was squarely supported by the German crown and German bishops. You see the battle lines. We'll talk more about this when we talk about Matilda of Tuscany and Pope Gregory VII. But suffice it to say that Honorius was called the anti-pope for a reason. He just didn't have the widespread support that Alexander enjoyed. Honorius II held on to the hopes of becoming the only pope for 11 years. Between 1061 and 1072, it was tense. But, again, Alexander II was the guy. However, the Council of Mantua on May 31st, 1072, changed all of that. Here's a little seed to plant. The Council of Mantua? Mantua was the hometown of Matilda of Tuscany. Don't forget about her. We will get to her. So this happened in her hometown. Alexander II was officially, across all the bishops of Christendom, formally declared the pope. At long last, there would be no entertaining an anti-pope option effective immediately. Honorius, even lacking the support of his German base now, ran off to Parma and remained a month or two, still declaring himself pope, by the way, until he too died. 1072 was shaping up to be a pretty rough year for notables around the medieval world. But the worst might be yet to come. Hang with me here. So do you remember Stigand from our series on the Norman conquest of England? Think back a little bit. Stigand was the powerful bishop who stuck around far longer than any betting man worth his salt would have put money on, somehow even surviving King William's purge of the Anglo-Saxon clergy back in 1070. Stigand, too, died after being pushed aside by William in favor of William's old friend and personal priest, the famous Lanfranc of Bec. But we already know about Stigand. We also know about Sancho II's death in 1072 from our series about El Cid. Remember Romanos IV? He also died in 1072, within a year after Manzikert. Back in Ireland, we see the death of one of the greatest Irish high kings in the pre-Norman era, after Brian Boru, of course. I'm going to try to pronounce his name. Dermot MacMail? I don't know. Help me out there, Irish listeners. In Wales, after the death of King Griffith, the only king of Wales, as far as I know, like ever, at least that's how he's announced, in 1063, Meredydd ap Uwain, I know I butchered that, reclaimed the title of the Prince of Deheubarth. Well, he held this title through the death of Harold Godwinson and through the meaty years of the Norman conquest of England, until his own death, you guessed it, in 1072. And what if I told you that, with the exception of Alp Arslan, none of these deaths, as important as they were, would be felt more acutely and longer than one more death the medieval era will experience that same year of 1072. We're going to travel back to Sicily now. Just as it was in our story about Alp Arslan's demise, it's the summer of 1072. After spending the previous fall, during the Siege of Palermo, running around Roger VI, smashing even the remotest whispers of Saracens, gathering to march on the Normans while they starved the city into submission, up to and including leading raiding parties as far away as Enna, just to be proactive about it all. Well, Serlo II was ready for a little rest and a little relaxation. He, of all people, had earned it. Serlo had been at Roger's side since before the Battle of Cerami 9 years earlier, and Roger couldn't imagine a conquest of Sicily without him. Thankfully, that January, Uncle Robert had acknowledged Serlo's badassery and rewarded the young man with vast landholdings to call his own. For a man who had quite literally spent the previous decade on horseback, doing all the dirty work for Roger, it was time to rest just for a play or two. And for those that enjoy American football, here's an analogy. I've honestly likened Serlo this whole time to the running back, and Roger to the quarterback. The quarterback may make the big, flashy plays and be the source of every single play, but the running back, he does most of the heavy lifting and puts his body on the line, whether he's running the ball or blocking some massive linebacker. Serlo was a running back. And the thing about running backs is they don't last very long. Okay, here's another comparison. For this one, think space. Okay, think outer space here. Some stars coalesce and live a long life, slowly and methodically burning up their energy until they fizzle out. Others are the exact opposite. Thankfully, our own star is right smack in the middle of these extremes. However, some stars coalesce and immediately expand into a star so big there might not be words for how huge and how bright and how powerful they quickly become. This kind of star, this was Serlo II de Hauteville, son of Serlo I, the heir to old Papa Tancred up in Normandy, and of course the nephew to Robert Guiscard and Roger. Serlo II burned as bright as they came there in the 11th century. One could arguably claim that few, maybe none, burned brighter than Serlo. By Palermo's fall in January 1072, Roger had trusted Serlo with just about everything, including making most of his own decisions about where to go and what to do while he was there. Serlo could read Roger perfectly by this time, and Serlo's gut told him to head toward the town of Nicosia. Today, you can drive the winding stretch of mountainous road between Nicosia and Cerami in central Italy in just about 30 minutes. And somewhere in that stretch, Serlo and his rugged band of Norman knights were ambushed. Norwich writes, quote, "Outnumbered many times over by the Saracen cavalry, he knew that he was doomed. But leaping onto a huge rock, he and his followers fought magnificently to the end and sold their lives dearly." End quote. Malaterra, writing mere decades after the incident and directly from the words of Roger, adds deeper context to the situation. Quote, "The Arabs stationed at Castrogiovanni were greatly threatened by Serlo's energy, since he launched many attacks against them, and they strove to encompass his ruin, both by force of arms and by treachery. Hence, in order to deceive him more easily, a certain Saracen named Brachium made an agreement with Serlo, and each verbally took the other as his adopted brother, as was the custom of their people. Then he arranged with his own people to betray him, and to deceive him further sent Serlo suitable gifts and friendly messages, among which he told them this, 'Let my adopted brother know that, on such and such day, in a deliberate act of vainglory, a group of only 7 Arabs will probably be making a foray into your land to plunder.' When Serlo heard this, he thought it was ridiculous and took no precautions at all, not bothering to summon anybody from neighboring castles to help him, while he himself rashly went out to hunt." End quote. So we see how Malaterra injected some deceit into the ambush, which calls into question a few things. Specifically, I wonder if Serlo is actually legit wrong in underestimating the situation and going out undermanned for his movements, which happens. I mean, even the best of us underestimate things from time to time. If so, I mean, we know that chroniclers run cover like today's mainstream media outlets do for their own leaders. So I wonder if Serlo did have a lapse in judgment. Was Malaterra merely deflecting blame off of the much beloved Serlo and onto something more easily palatable to his Christian readers, something like Muslim treachery? There's no way of knowing for sure, I think, But questioning the sources of our information, even if they turn out to be trustworthy, is not only a historian's top priority, at least in my humble opinion, but all of our top priorities. Either way, Malaterra adds that the Muslim forces numbered around 700 cavalry and 2,000 infantry. These figures are without question ballooned to make it seem like it would take that much to take down a demigod like Serlo. But we get the idea that Serlo was indeed entirely outnumbered. Our chronicler Malaterra writes, quote, "Seeing his enemies charging from ambush and hearing the horrid clash of arms at his rear, Serlo refused to rely on flight, even though he had only a minimum force with him, but he and his few companions made their way to a rock, which from that day onward was known as Serlo's Rock. He climbed up it, placed his back to it like a wall, and with no help in prospect from any direction, stood at bay. Finally, he was struck down and killed, and of all those who were with him, only two, who lay hidden among the bodies of the dead, survived." End quote. And here's where the tragic, island-shaking death of Serlo II de Hauteville gets a bit gruesome, so just fair warning if there are little campers listening. It also reminds me of the story of the Norman Moor Eater. Remember Roger de Tosny? Which was a boogeyman story created by Iberian Muslims to vilify the Normans decades earlier. So just take this for what it's worth. Malaterra, quote, "Serlo was disemboweled and the Saracens tore out his heart and are alleged to have eaten it, so that they might share in the bravery for which he had been framed. They sent the severed heads of those who had been slain as a present to their king in Africa, but Serlo's head was placed on a pike and carried through the city squares with a herald announcing that the man who more than anybody else had threatened Sicily had been conquered by his enemies. With nobody else like him surviving, Sicily could certainly rejoice at his death." End quote. Now this probably accurately showed the extent to which Serlo's legend had grown by the summer of 1072, even if, as Richard Brown in his book, Count Roger of Sicily, Portrait of a Ruler, points out that the whole cannibalism thing was most definitely a figment of Malaterra's imagination. Either way, Serlo was no joke. Malaterra goes on to say that the news devastated the entire Norman population across Sicily and southern Italy. I personally would venture to guess that by the time the news reached Normandy itself, it might have had a few shockwaves there as well. I mean, it's not like the Hautevilles were a very small clan. Everybody knew him. Now, quote, "The count was stricken with grief at the loss of his nephew," writes Malaterra. Norwich says that Roger was inconsolable. Quote, "Robert, we're told, made a manly show of hiding his own tears, not wishing to add to his brother's grief," end quote. And on that, I'll add what Malaterra writes, which made me chuckle, actually. Quote, "The Duke wanted to put an end to his brother's lament and urged the Count to hide his sorrow and behave like a man. Women are allowed to be sorrowful," he said. "We, however, should put on our armor and take revenge." End quote. Kind of funny, 11th century. Things sometimes just don't change, for better or for worse. And that seems to be actually what played out, though it wouldn't be swift and it would be very dirty and very deadly still. The conquest of Sicily continues, with or without Serlo II. And within a month or two of Serlo's death, we see Duke Robert Guiscard leave Sicily for the very last time. Though the two brothers would help each other over the ensuing years, Robert would never return to his Duchy of Sicily ever again. Malaterra writes, following the death of their beloved younger kinsman Serlo, quote, "Thereafter, both brothers acted separately and strove to forward their own individual interests, except that when it was really necessary and one was asked by the other, each of them went to bring help to the other." End quote. Roger's fealty still firmly his brothers, his dukes. But it seems that by the end of 1072, the two brothers would surely embark on two different paths in life. So, which path should we take here? Let's stay on the island of Sicily, since we're already there. By the end, we'll pivot to the mainland and see what Robert's up to. As for the Grand Count of Sicily, Roger quickly got to work. That's what Roger did. And in the wake of Serlo's death, it was probably exactly what Roger needed the most. The first thing Roger did was stay in Palermo just a little longer after Robert left, as there was the refortification of both Alcacer and Alcalisa, as well as the patching up and upgrading of Palermo's harbor and docks and all that stuff, right? His biggest hurdle was to reiterate the Duke's declarations months earlier when Palermo initially fell. It would have been incredibly easy and very Norman, let's be honest, to renege on the deals Robert had made with the Palermitan elite back in January. But Roger decided to follow his brother's wishes. But that didn't mean that Palermo would just be left alone. No, Roger still had some things to arrange and rearrange before he was happy with the situation. Norwich writes about, quote, the establishment of a Norman administration to supplement the already existing Saracen institutions, end quote. To oversee any and all Saracen power, Roger created a governor of Palermo, and this person was to rule as if Grand Count Roger was actually present in Palermo. However, in a twist that would have far-reaching impacts into the next century and beyond, Roger didn't give it a French name. Roger called this position of governor of Palermo, Emir. To underestimate the impact that made on the local Saracens, you can't, right? Norwich writes, quote, it was the first Sicilian example of that characteristic Norman readiness to adopt local forms and customs, and of that easy eclecticism which was to give their new country so much of its character and strength, end quote. Now, it's also worth adding that it was more than just calling the governor Emir. Before Robert had left, he not so casually mentioned that his siege on Palermo, well, it cost him quite a bit of coin, quite a bit of horses, supplies, ships, and certainly men. Reading the not-so-subtle writing on the wall, the Palermitans quickly replenished Robert's forces with what he needed, and in an act of goodwill, even a bit more. But this included men, too. A hefty number of Saracens joined Duke Robert on his return trip to Apulia, which is just another example of integration between these two groups of people. As for Roger, he began to do the same. His army was no longer wholly or mostly reliant on Normans heading south. His ranks, too, began to grow across Sicily with not just Normans and Lombards, but of those local Greeks, and most notably now, Saracens. Roger enjoyed increasing integration as well, but being in the very land of the two warring sides, it was slower to come. Upon Robert Guiscard's departure, the vast army he'd assembled was free, having been paid by the briefcase full of cash, land, titles, honors, and treasures. However, Roger was still in Sicily, and he still needed an army, so he convinced many to stay on. Malaterra tells us that Roger, quote, was like a raging lion, eager for plunder, impatient for peace, appearing everywhere, the first to be present when some especially dangerous mission was undertaken, and refusing to abandon an operation once it was set into motion, end quote. Roger was finally able to lean into the conquest in full, and apparently, he loved it. Robert Brown, in his book Count Roger of Sicily, explains the island had fundamentally shifted after the fall of Palermo. Picture Sicily for a second, or actually, if you want, head over to Facebook or Instagram, X, Patreon, to see some of the recent visual media I've created to help with maps and whatnot. I feel like that it helps me, so it might help you as well. Now, if you were to draw a line from Agrigento in the west to Catania in the east, you're left with a triangle about one-third the size of the island itself. This southern triangle has three main points of contact: Agrigento in the west, Catania in the east, and Syracuse in the south. Now, this region was really the only region that was almost entirely, by 1072, ruled by Muslim emirs and chieftains. If you're wondering about Catania, by the way, after Roger's scheming, they weren't too happy with him, so the city itself may have been Roger's, but the region of the same name, specifically the area south of the city, had more or less thrown its support toward the Syracusan leadership. A little shift there as well. Also, another interesting point is that Muslim-held Enna also lies just north of this region, meaning even the surrounding regions below that indomitable mountain fortress were more and more under pressure from the Normans. Spoiler alert, even with the northern two-thirds of Sicily being either firmly Norman or tangentially undermined enough to put leadership into question, Brown writes, quote, "The conquest of the remainder of the island was to last a further 20 years," end quote. Sobering to think about Sicily in comparison to England in terms of Norman conquests in the 11th century. So how did Roger begin to lock down this northern two-thirds then? Well, first, by the end of 1072, in the wake of Duke Robert heading back to Apulia, and of course in the wake of the tragic death of Serlo, Roger got to work setting up, well, you can probably guess, castles, right? There were two main ones that stood out. Mazara was a large town in the far west of Sicily, directly south of the Muslim stronghold of Trapani, which was way up in the farther northwestern reaches of Sicily. Mazara would be Roger's western Mediterranean lookout, specifically to have a base of operations from which to subdue the western Saracen populations and bend them into Norman rule. But let's be honest, Mazara also served as a watchtower, a lighthouse of sorts for any possible Zirid fleets looking to take back Palermo. The second major castle Roger built was an attempt to lock down the entire region of Catania, not just the city itself in the northern areas, but a forward position from which to push further south toward Syracuse. This castle was at the town of Paterno, on the southwestern foothills of Mount Etna. Mazara and Paterno, two critical outposts for Roger's continued conquest as 1072 came to a close. Now, as for Duke Robert, who had left Sicily riding a high like he'd never experienced before, again, as I said a couple episodes ago, Palermo was supreme. He landed in Calabria, only to find out that his nephew Abelard and his little rebellion was completely overblown and wasn't really much of a threat. In fact, it was kind of fizzling at the time. However, the Duke's own brother-in-law was stirring up trouble. This brother-in-law would mean he was the brother of Robert Guiscard's own wife, Sicilgaita, and his name, the brother-in-law, was Gisulf II, and at this point he was only 22 years old. Gisulf had taken over as Prince of Salerno after the assassination of his father by some folks from the nearby Principality of Amalfi. Brown writes of him, quote, "He was hardly a worthy successor to his great father, whose principality had extended over most of the Mezzogiorno, and he appears as a villain and a pirate in the Chronicle of Amatus of Monte Cassino." John Julius Norwich in The Normans in the South speaks, quote, "of one unfortunate victim, an Amalfitan, whom Gisulf kept in an icy dungeon, removing first his right eye and then, every day, one more of his fingers and toes. He," that is Amatus, "adds that Empress Agnes, who is spending much of her time in South Italy, personally offered 100 pounds of gold and one of her own fingers in ransom, but her prayers were unheard," end quote. Yeah, that was Agnes, the Queen Regent of Germany, coming all the way down because she heard the terror that Gisulf II was releasing upon this Amalfitan man. So yeah, Gisulf II, kind of a tyrant. But he was also a bit of a petulant little brat, as you can probably imagine, which is funny because Agnes was raising one of her own, but I'm jumping ahead a bit. See, over the previous several months, Gisulf had thrown his support behind Abelard and his little brother Hermann. Was he thinking that his support and resources would be enough to do what the Byzantines were unable to do? Hardly. He was more just being a pain in his brother-in-law's backside. Brown reports that, quote, the rising accomplished little but to irritate further his powerful brother-in-law, end quote. So what happens when you poke a bear, especially a bear that's coming off his two largest victories yet? Well, due to his association with Giscard's rebellious nephews, Giscard quickly set up a castle near the borders of Calabria and Salerno. Make no mistake, this was a direct threat to Gisulf. However, Gisulf made it clear he wanted to extend his principality to the extents that his father enjoyed. And hearing that Giscard was conducting raids on areas quite close by, according to Malaterra, quote, he treated those of Giscard's men whom he could capture with brutality and did not conceal his hostility to our people, end quote. Now, I'm going to put a pin in that storyline for the time being, but I promise you, we will return to the Salerno situation in a future episode. However, very soon after Giscard reached Calabria and set up those castles, he decided he wasn't quite finished with the Adriatic coast, still home to many loyal Byzantine Greeks. He pushed past his home of Melfi, and he slammed his army headfirst into the coastal port city of Trani, just north of Bari, on February 2, 1073. Many smaller cities in the area quickly fell to Robert's overwhelming forces, and by March, he was even able to capture the two most powerful men in Trani, guys named Peter and Herman. No, that's not a joke. Peter and Herman. But apparently, that was kind of a big deal. Herman, by the way, was Abelard's little brother. All right, so here's where Robert once again assumes the nickname Giscard in full glory. Peter of Trani was actually the lord of a city named Sistrustino. Giscard ties Peter to what Norwich calls, quote-unquote, a great wattle screen, which is basically woven wood into a fence or screen in order to corral livestock. That's what wattle screens are. Yeah, he ties this Byzantine nobleman to the front and pushes the helpless guy humiliatingly toward his own town in front of the army. This prevented any resistance, because if Sistrustino would have attacked, they would have probably hit their own baron. Not a good look. Norwich writes, quote-unquote, Peter himself could only cry out to them to surrender. They obeyed. Brilliant. And with that, whatever uprising Abelard de Hauteville and his brother Herman, those spiteful little nephews of his, had stirred up, more or less, was squashed with Robert's capture of Sistrustino. Now, Richard of Capua, one of the proxy co-conspirators in this little uprising, still had little contingents of knights, set up in the town of Canossa de Puglia, just west of Bari, toward the Apennine Mountains. Now, the Apennines were the mountain range that ran down the spine of Italy, if you can picture it. However, due to a shortage of water, Canossa de Puglia surrendered the moment Robert's forces peeked over the horizon, and Richard of Capua just recalled his men. Once again, Robert had reconquered Apulia, the northern part this time, the part closest to the people that hated him most. Slowly but surely, Apulia was learning, and it was becoming less hostile each time. In fact, Robert even let Peter of Trani have his lands, his title, his wealth, including his city of Sistrustino back. Well, after he unstrapped the poor humiliated wretch from the wattle, that is. Norwich gives further insight, though. Quote, Robert's clemency did not, however, extend to all his other erstwhile enemies. With a minor Apulian baron, he could afford to be generous, but Richard of Capua presented a more serious long-term threat to his position. End quote. Over the previous 14 years, since that meeting at Melfi, where Robert had become Duke, and if you remember, Richard of Capua was also invested with certain titles and honorifics and land, while Duke Robert had solidified his land holdings and political reach across Apulia, Calabria, and now Sicily, see, during that time, Richard of Capua had been growing his own army and his own navy, as well as his political reach in the polities around central Italy. between Rome and Amalfi, and as far inland as the Apennines, Richard of Capua was the undisputed ruler, and he had really got in good with Archdeacon Hildebrand, putting him on great terms with Pope Alexander II, who luckily was friendly with everybody in the region. Lucky for him, actually. To make matters worse between the two powerful Italian men, when Richard of Capua had asked a robber who was knee-deep in his siege at Bari at the time, he had asked him for men to help put down local rebellions around Campania, which is the region just south of Rome. Guiscard had given them to Richard. However, when Guiscard asked for a return on the favor to help in Palermo recently, Richard of Capua had promised him upwards of 150 knights, but not a single knight showed up. Instead, records show that Richard had actually sent them the opposite direction. He sent them to help Abelard against Robert while Robert was away. It's worth noting that Richard of Capua was also a brother-in-law to Robert as well. Norwich adds, quote, "It seemed a curious way for a brother-in-law to repay past kindnesses. The Prince of Capua was, in short, too strong, too slippery, and too dangerous. He would have to be dealt with." End quote. In Trani, in late spring of 1073, Duke Robert prepared for his big march against Richard of Capua. But his hulking frame couldn't keep up any longer, and Robert Guiscard fell terribly ill. He was moved to Bari, but nothing seemed to help him heal. Like, I can't stress it enough, he was in a bad way. He was so sick, so close to death, apparently, that Sicilgeita, the well-respected wife, called Robert's noblemen together and forced an election of an heir. You're probably thinking, well, it would be Robert's firstborn son, right? Of course, primogeniture. It's a very Norman practice. So the noblemen gathered at the word of Sicilgeita. They gathered and they elected Mark de Hauteville, also known by his nickname, Bohemond, right? I mean, Bohemond was Robert's firstborn son. But remember, Bohemond was not Sicilgeita's son. Bohemond was born to Robert's first wife, a marriage he'd dissolved so he could marry into the nobility of Salerno, right? Bohemond wasn't even put up for a vote due to his status as bastard. But there's quite a bit of reason to believe that Bohemond was at his father's side during all of this, including his siege of Palermo the year earlier. I can't stress enough that Bohemond was incredibly valued by Duke Robert. In my own mind, I'm keeping Bohemond as close to Robert as Serlo was to Roger. However, again, Bohemond wasn't even mentioned, so far as we know, not in those meetings anyway. In fact, the nephew Abelard claimed he had a greater stake in Robert's duchies than any of Robert's sons. Well, I mean, to be fair, Abelard still claimed that he had a stronger claim to these duchies than Robert did, so there's that, being, again, Humphrey's son. Either way, it turns out that while Guiscard was dying in some bed in Trani, Sicilgeita was orchestrating her firstborn son, named Roger, yes, named after his super cool uncle over in Sicily, which shows you how far Robert and Roger's relationship had come, as Robert's official heir. It's not much of a surprise, but it's worth mentioning. Seems how both Bohemond and Roger will play some pretty pivotal roles in upcoming events. I should add that history knows Robert Guiscard's son, Roger, as Roger Borsa. Borsa translates to purse, which 1,000 years ago, a purse had a slightly different connotation than it does today. A purse then was simply a bag that kept coins safe. Every nobleman had one, or many of them, depending on what the transaction was. Young Roger was known for counting, recounting, and counting again coins when he was growing up. So the nickname just stuck. Roger Borsa. Don't forget that name. So every noble but one. I'll give you one guess as to who the holdout would have been. every noble but one voted to accept young Roger Borsa as Duke Robert's heir. Word of Guiscard's illness and Roger Borsa's election swept across southern Italy. As far as anyone knew, the one and only Robert Guiscard was finally dead. News of Guiscard's death shocked the Mediterranean world, and the news reached Rome at the end of April. However, Rome, and Christendom at large, was mourning the loss of another giant name, Pope Alexander II, who had outlived his rival, Antipope Honorius II, by less than 1 year, and the city was in the midst of prayers for a smooth succession there. Rumors abound in southern Italy in April 1073. Who is this Roger Borsa kid who's taken over for the greatest Norman thus far in southern Italy? Who would be the new pope? What would Bohemond, the only one of Robert Guiscard's children to have inherited a lick of Hauteville military prowess and cunning, what would he have to say about all this? On the next episode, we actually start to pull in Matilda of Tuscany, but maybe more importantly, a man named Archdeacon Hildebrand, because his impact on all of these things is just unrivaled. He has his hands in everything. And on the next episode, we're going to take a look at him. And I can't wait to tell you about it.